We are starting the Mystic Pete Chronicles, and I'm Mystic Pete. Every week, through interviews with thought leaders, visionaries, and creatives, and stories, music, and humor, we'll do some deep ponders in this time of great change, and have some fun. If you'd like more information about today's guests, or to be interviewed for the show yourself, I'm at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. In today's show, I interview the magnificent Michael Mobley. Stay tuned. So it is March 14th, 2023. Mystic Pete here with Michael Mobley. And I met you, Michael, I guess it was around 2011, 12. And at the time, you were this, like, this gorgeous man with these long golden locks and this kind of buzzy, beautiful musician. Playing around town. I don't know that we were real close, but we were kind of friendly at that time. And you were kind of a rising star. And then all of a sudden, you're on TV all over the place. You're on The Tonight Show. You're on Conan. You're on Jimmy Kimmel. So that's 2013 with the Mobleys. And this is your band. And you're Michael Mobley. You are like the lead. And your songs and so forth. Anyway, we ended up becoming closer after that and played a few gigs together and this and that and went to see some shows. And, you know, we had a nice little friendship and we connect over the years. But you explained to me how that all came down at one point. And I thought it was such a touching story. And I wanted to get that on tape for the listeners and just talk to you generally because you're such a magical, enchanted character in any case. So you were in this scene in LA, mm-hmm. and it was a very creative, kind of interactive things, and a band came out of it
mm-hmm.
called the Mobleys.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about that scene a little bit and then how everything kind of blew up.
Mm. That scene, it came right after we had written the song, like, the big Mobley song, San Francisco, the one that, like, launched the whole thing. And that came from a trip to San Francisco with me and one of the other leads, Colin. He calls me, he's like, let's go to San Francisco. My mom invited us up to have dinner with her. She lives in Kansas, but they were up there doing something, so it's close enough to go for a visit. And we came home with that song. I immediately recorded it on this old, old Pro Tools rig that I had. And, in this garage, and when I finished that recording, I called one of my mentors and was like, yo, how do I start a record label? Because I was also playing with a couple other cats, and I was just like, all my friends were doing badass stuff at the time, like just so many musical projects were occurring, and then other people were doing other mediums, and there's like a vibe happening, and we were like, you know, it's like, college is just ending for most of us, and we're like in this space, we're like, what are we doing? And like, there's a lot of fire. And I was like, how can we start a label and like get all these things together? And
there was a little like a space you were gathering in, or a little open mic thing or something like that. Wasn't there a little community?
That was a bit later. The second community emerged.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
So there was this first wave.
This first wave was like, my mentor, he said, he's like, why don't we start a collective, not a label? Why don't we like work together and everybody support each other and let's do something like that? I'm like, that sounds way more my vibe. I think I had done Burning Man twice at this point. And like, I credit a lot of the inspiration for my first trip to Burning Man in 08 and the fact that I was working in a Catholic church that housed 1,200 parishioners per mass. I was running sound and I was occasionally the cantor. And I was just like obsessed with this sound of everybody singing together. And at that church, there were four different languages often on Sundays. And each language that came in was these different people, but they had completely different vibes. And even the way that they worshiped was like, I felt like I was going on into Small World almost, because it was like different garb would come in, like all these things I had never seen before from these different places around the world. And I just noticed that the same thing, no matter what language they spoke, the same thing would occur when they would all sing together, and this sound. And I was just like, oh my gosh, and people experiencing this like deep level of what I attribute to the word like revival. Yeah, and like transcendent moment of unity. And I went to Burning Man like 4 months into being the sound engineer and cantor at this church and just getting out of audio school. And my mind was blown. And yeah, after that, it was just like the Mowgli's construction began. And
so it started on a kind of trip to San Francisco, and the song came through and you recorded it.
So yeah, so the song comes through, we record it, and this sort of vibe of community and like carrying that spirit and wanting everyone to sing and rock together, it enabled us to like organize, and we made this website, and everybody started recording their music and putting it up, and Bandcamp was just fresh. We were on Bandcamp, and like that's how we distributed stuff, and we were throwing shows at the Dragonfly in Hollywood, and like 300 people would come down on a Monday night. It was crazy. We were killing it.
What was their name to this group?
The Collective CA is what it was called.
The Collective CA.
Yeah, and we would throw Mana Festivals. I think we might be like one of the first Mana Festivals that ever existed. My friend came up with that. He's like, why don't you call it the Mana Festival? And because we were like all on Venice. We had just gotten to kind of Venice and like hippie stuff and Burning Man. We're like in that space. We're like super conscious for the first time. Yeah, like we just discovered yoga.
Yep.
100% LA Hollywood story. And I grew up here, so it's just like it was so embedded. So that whole thing happened, and the Mowglis were essentially like this all-star super band from all these other projects in the collective, and I had grown up with like over half of those kids who all lived in San Fernando Valley. Like the San Fernando Valley was our base. That was our thing. We were like all the punk rock musician kids from high school still going for it and getting way better at it. And this scene emerged, and we had like a good, I want to say like a year, maybe a year and a half of rocking, and then everything fell apart. All the bands started breaking up. I was in like four or five of the bands, and it was just like band drop, band drop, band drop. The drama, it was like we lived it. The sex, drugs, and rock and roll, man.
And egos start to emerge.
Oh, yeah.
And I want it my way, and I want publishing for this, and I wrote the song, and I want to be the... So all these...
All the things.
Real world issues happen. But so you wrote the song... There's a kind of collective that happens. You're doing these shows at the Dragonfly. There's a major club on Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah, it's on Santa Monica. It's a dope club.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, this is a major LA club.
It's a sick club.
Come on.
I love it.
Yeah. If you can fill the Dragonfly, you are somebody to watch.
It was great. We would do two stages. So we had like a stage on the floor in the second room. And they actually put a stage in that room. I think we contributed to them doing that. We would go Warped Tour style, band, band, band. So we could stack the night with like 10 bands instead of only having four or five.
And there
would be no break in programming because there's no changeover.
Bringing in 300 paying people to any show is hard in LA.
Yeah. And then when you have 10 bands, it makes it a lot easier.
Oh, right.
But most of us were all, there was probably like five bands worth of people playing in every band.
But that's an accomplishment. So from there,
the collective starts falling apart. The Mowglis are still going strong. And as the collective starts to fall apart, it kind of enabled everybody. Because like, it was like each of us had our own side projects. Everything started like withering away. And the Mowglis then got to be the focus. And then it's like, then the record label came. And
this is your label.
this note that like we attracted a real record label.
Okay, so you and guys are like, getting a little buzz. You're packing these clubs, and the Mowgli's is kind of the remaining little gemstone of this whole scene.
Yeah, one of them. There are two. There's one remaining gemstone that still exists and took it way further than anyone, and that's the Human Experience.
Okay,
David Block. Yeah.
Oh, that came out of this.
David and I grew up together, and he was in the collective, and it was like the whole collective fell, and it was the Mowgli's and the Human Experience, and David maintained like the most true to the spirit of the collective and the vibe, and he was like, he still gives his music away for free. One thing, when we signed with the label, the Mowgli's, like, it broke my heart that we were going to sell the music. It killed me, which was also like detrimental to my own artistic business, because to be so dedicated to giving everything away for free makes it very hard to survive when it's what you spend all your time and energy on.
Well, this spirit you have, this feeling about music being kind of free and to bring people together and a unifying force, this part is very important to the story later on. So you're going up. You have a label now.
Yeah.
You have some questions about it, but then success.
It starts to break. And the argument is that it's like we have this chance to go out there and get this love message, which in a lot of ways, you know, a lot of what's in some of those lyrics was coming from me. I was raised Catholic and I'm working in this church now. I denounced in sixth grade, but I still honor it as my family's heritage, and I still participate with my family because it's one of the ways we bond. And I just like go in there and I try to absorb the best parts and keep an open mind. And so some of it is like essentially like it's soaked into me, this love gospel, like the loviest words, just like, you know, the most basic ones, the golden rule stuff, you know, peace and like... Yeah, and so we felt there was this opportunity and responsibility to get it out.
The Mowgli's.
The Mowgli's, like, being a vessel for messages that we were trying to make them... We were trying to adopt universal doctrine from sacred texts that were about a unity and oneness and helping your fellow human at all costs and, you know, like, getting everybody to a level of comfort. And, like, just sort of trying to add to this spirit of motivation that helps people help other people was sort of the vibe.
This is the spirit behind your music and behind you. This is just foundational to who you are.
Yes.
And so going...
It's a blessing and a curse.
Going the legit route with a label seemed like a good vehicle to move the message ahead. I mean, you know, we all grow up and put aside our young idealism and fantasies for maybe something that will be more powerful in a bigger form. I mean, that's a reasonable analysis, a reasonable decision, and that's what you guys decided to do.
So we go from there, and it basically was in like the course of like 2 weeks or something. We sign with this label. I accept that I've sold my soul to the devil. It was crazy. I made the label promise me one thing right before we signed. I was like, let the record ride for 1 week free on Bandcamp after, because it was like we're signing to a subsidiary of Island. There's gonna be a big press release and Universal Music Group, and so like it was a big deal. A lot of people were going to find out about us all of a sudden. And I was like, let the record be free for 1 week. And this weird thing, I was actually with Liana this one night. I feel like you were involved somehow. I might have seen you this one night. I get this feeling like the record label was going to do something weird. And I wanted to go in and like change all the Bandcamp passwords so that they couldn't get in there for some reason, because we signed the deal on like a Friday night after business hours, and I had all the contracts, and I was like, I told her, I was just like, I think we had gone to see Spangl at the Palladium.
Okay.
Spangl. Amazing show.
I know.
Just amazing. And then we went to Terra Chroma after hours. It was awesome. And during that show, I got this sense that I was like, I need to go to the car and light the contracts on fire. Because this label's whack. the ink's not dry. I'm getting this bad feeling. And she convinced me. She's like, dude, this is in your head. And you're putting this into the universe. And, like, in a sense, by going and changing it and locking them out, you're dishonoring the agreement you just agreed to. And I was like, whew, you're so right. I didn't light anything on fire. Nothing was locked out. Come Monday morning, I'm locked out. The record is off Bandcamp. And I'm calling up, and I'm like, what is going on? We are fresh into this new relationship, and now I'm bound to them. And they're like, literally, sorry. I need you to take my lead on this one.
Trust us.
This came down from the top. We can't do it. Got it. And I'm like, that was the one thing. I asked for 1 week. You said yes. I signed it. It's not in writing.
Right.
It's
the words.
It was a chat and handshake, like the last thing that did it. And he's just like, sorry, dude.
Yep.
And I was like, boom, locked out. And from that moment, I felt like I never had the reins again. And this thing that I had been working on for years and did, you know, poured my heart and soul into, and that I was guiding to this place. From that moment on, everything that I was trying to accomplish was denied. Whew. And I was like working in some weird diplomatic, political, like, neutral way, because everybody knew that I was this thing that wanted to do something that they felt threatened their new brand. That was trouble. But we went from signing that, but that same week, there are all these good things happening, and I'm, like, devastated and freaking out. Like, we get signed, the announcement goes out, and then it's about to be the World Series. San Francisco Giants, I don't remember who they were playing, are the team. And the series, the first few games are in San Francisco. The Giants win in a sweep. And they get the Mowgli's, the San Francisco song, into the stadium. They're playing it every night during the games. And we're like, signed, everything's going wrong, but we're being played. Then we're like, iTunes Song of the Week. 300,000 people download it for free. And they're like, see, you're getting, we're going to give it to you, this thing, in some weird shifty backwards way that doesn't look anything like what you hoped it did, but we're not gonna give you all of it, but we'll give you like a little bit of the thing that we agreed to. I'm like, okay, I guess, like, I'll take, you know, like, whatever. I'm in bed with the evil thing, or what I view as the evil thing, and I'm trying to go in there and help change it from the inside like an incendiary, and I'm like just biting my teeth and going for it. And then from there it was like, boom, major national tour. Then we're on the TV shows. Then summer comes around and we're like in the midway flyer, like the tier on the flyer. Like, we're not the smallest font. We're not up there at the big, but we're like higher up. Then I'm like, whoa. And we're like, boom, festival, 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 festival.
And people are coming to see you. Yeah, they're paying money to see your band.
It's crazy. There were 10,000 people to see us at Lollapalooza in 2013. And I was just like, what is going on right now?
And this
huge crowd. Like, it was insane.
All off the strength of that one song, which was a hit, San Francisco. That was your...
was the thing.
That was your song. And that, you wrote that song a few years earlier.
So I wrote that with Colin, with the other lead, in San Francisco. But I wrote the riff about 5 months prior. And a lot of times when I get a riff, like when something comes through, I don't know if it's like a synesthetic thing or a schizophrenic thing or whatever it is, but like the music and it comes up with the flutes too. Like, instruments and sounds and songs will communicate with me. I don't believe that it's me, like, having a conversation with myself. I believe that there's an external thing communicating with me. And the song, like the riff when it first came through, it was like, you need to bring this to Colin, this riff. And like, this riff is for him. And I was like, okay. And I showed it to him a few times, and he didn't, like, it. Nothing happened. I thought, like, something would click and, like, this whole thing would happen. That's kind of what happened with our first song, The Great Divide. I showed it to him, and he, like, immediately had a chorus and was like, oh my gosh, this fits so perfect. It was from one of his other songs, and we, like, merged them together, and it, like, just was puzzle pieces.
It was a true co-write.
Yeah, it was a true thing.
You're a collaborator.
Uh-huh. But so, on this trip to San Francisco, and funnily enough, we're in the alley. We've gone to see The Human Experience, who's performing at this thing called Green Fest, which is, like, the most vegan, green, hippie, alternative biofuel event, like, that I'd ever been to at the time, and it was so underground. and there weren't a ton of people there, and it was kind of before that movement was really starting to grow. We went to see our friend David. He's performing there, and we got to go in the Green Fest, and outside in the alley, I pulled the guitar out, and we're hanging out, and we're just in San Francisco. We have, like, the night free, and we're not seeing his mom till the next night, and I play him the riff again, and now he, like, hears it, and I was, and we, like, it was there. I was like, and I almost wonder if, like, we're, like, operating through some kind of quantum time travel, where it's like, we've already made this thing, and we're really just remembering it. Sometimes it feels like that. Yeah, and then we got cooking, and then we ended up staying an extra night, because we had, like, the song. We came home with the finished song. And we basically, in two hotel rooms, wrote that song over, like, a 48-hour period. And we dropped everything. Like, it was our existence. And neither of us had any money. We were living on Starbucks gift cards that my grandma had given me over, like, five Christmases that I had never used. And so I was like, we're going on the road. I was like, do you have money? He's like, my mom can give us a little bit. And I was like, oh, man. I was like, I think I have, like, $200 worth of gift cards. And we were, like, living on egg sandwiches and coffee at Starbucks. We were never hungry or without coffee. And we're like, that's how we did it. It was amazing.
So, and it was really several years later. So 2013, you're on the Tonight Show.
Yeah, so it's 09 when the song is written.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, I turn on the Tonight Show and I see you and I go, like, yeah, this is this guy I've been kind of hanging out with a little, you know, part of the community scene. And, like, a part of me's totally jealous, because I had, like, my own bands, and I'm working hard and trying everything I know and spending all this money, and it's going nowhere. I'm going, like, here's this, like, gorgeous man on the Tonight Show singing, and everybody's loving him, and he's blowing up. But, I mean, a part of me was really happy for you, but a part, I mean, I guess envy is one of this deadly sin that I struggle with. And God, I wish I was him. And he's, anyway, let's get back to you. But so you have your moment of just, like, somewhere between the fact that it was about San Francisco and the Giants won, and it was a great song, and you guys looked good, and the angels just put it all together, and suddenly you're hot.
Boom.
Yeah. And a lot of TV, festivals. I mean, this is, like, what we all want. We want that big hit. We want to be packing the festivals. We all want the women, you know, after us. This is, and you just, like, that dream just came down to earth. And here it is.
Uh-huh.
Michael Mowgli.
All of it.
Boom.
Boom. And
before we get to the other side of the mountain,
yeah,
just say another word about what that moment was like when you were in the limelight, and it's kind of all coming true.
It was the most bittersweet, blessed and cursed feelings I had ever felt. And again, this goes back to, like, the moment that we had signed, like, that deal not being honored was the vibe. And not only that, like, it made me feel like I had sacrificed a big part of the intention, and now I'm up there having my dream, and the fulfillment that I thought that I would receive was, like, soured. And I was just trying to hold on and do my best to, like, express that joy and live in that joy, but simultaneously it was, like, it was this bitter thing. Because, like, there were strange things happening within the band, and friendships were being torn, and, like, as we all started to blow up and our egos started to inflate, things were between us. Like, there were all of a sudden there, I was, like, isolated in a van full of all my friends, eight of my best friends. I felt like none of us were together anymore, and there was, like, a weird thing occurring, and we were all just trying to, like, keep it straight and go and do this thing. And it was so strange. It was like I had spent my entire life trying to get to this moment, and when I got there, I was like, everything is wrong and I am lost, and this is not where I wanted to go. And it's so strange. I did my best to, like, enjoy it, because we were whisked and we did, like, hundreds of shows, huge shows. We're getting, like, crazy paychecks. and the whole
and
time.
And money, yes, yeah. And money.
Like, it was crazy. Like, San Francisco, the city of San Francisco paid us, like, some incredible amount of money to go play at their marathon, because they have just big budgets for stuff like that. And we were like, what the heck is going on? And then the Levi's store is like, come play for us the night before in San Francisco. We're doing our grand opening. And we're like getting dressed with fresh clothes. The whole band's getting fitted. And like a stylist of the Levi's crew is like hooking us up. And we've like never looked this good. And, you know, and like they're paying us to play at their thing. And it was just
thousands of dollars.
Amazing. Like dream coming true. And us all internally like, or me anyway, like unraveling at the seams, just completely like, oh my gosh. And like these things would start to occur that were slowly starting to break my spirit. And like one of them is that we're planning this show with one of our dear friends, my best friend. And he's got this venue booked in San Francisco. And it's like the biggest show he's ever booked. It's his birthday. It's his record release party. We've been planning it for months. And we started planning it, I think, before the band got signed. And we're already like starting to get... We already have this buzz. Maybe it was after. I'm not sure. But we're planning it at the early signs of... at the early part of the band getting the buzz. And it's for the Great American Music Hall in San Francisco. And he's never booked a venue this big. And their talent buyer knew about us, and they're like, if the Mowglis and you are doing this show, you've got it, no deposit, like, just we'll help it happen. We know that there's going to be some people here. And so they granted it to us, and we were going to throw this co-headlining show, and it's going to be great celebration for everybody. And it comes the time. We've already done the Tonight Show once at this point. We've done the Conan show. We're, like, in that circuit. We're on all their radar. And it's like 5 days before the San Francisco, the Great American show, and with Papa Bear and the Easy Love. And they call us and they're like, we're pulling you from the San Francisco gig. You got Kimmel. And I'm like, no. Excuse me. I'm like, no, we're not. We're not playing. We'll go another night. There's clearly a cancellation. Like, it's 4 days from now or whatever. We're going to play it another night. We're already in there. Like, guys, we cannot back out of this show to go play San Francisco, this song that is about love and friendship. If we bail on our friend for this big thing that we're committed to, like, it's... The band might as well not mean anything.
So you had to choose between playing the live show that was important or playing Jimmy Kimmel.
Yes.
It was one or the other.
One or the other. And this is early, so this is like February 2013. Like, we are just starting to blow. And I'm already soured because of the label thing, and like, things are weird. But when I looked at my band, and I looked at my team, and all of everyone's families, everybody, like my own family, like, you're going on Kimmel, right? And I'm like, no. 50 people that we're involved with, we're going to San Francisco. And everyone is hard no. And I'm crazy. I'm like literally looked at like I'm an insane person. What's wrong with you? He's trouble. And they're all talking. All the talking heads are talking. Like, we call it like the gas. You know, like the Hollywood gas. Like, you're getting all... And then you're like, your eyes are spinning stars and dollar signs, and suddenly... You're like operating by a different compass, and
you want to keep your commitment to do what's right. And
yes.
Everybody's saying, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
We can be on Jimmy Kimmel
in
this national platform. Goodbye, San Francisco. Like, it was obvious to everyone else what a poor decision that would be to honor your commitment. But to you, it was like everything. Like,
yes,
I'm a decent human being. I'm not going to just bail on all these people who I promised to.
And not only that, it's like the odds of us getting another night. They called, so we were on their list. We were like on the short list of like, someone canceled, call the Mowglis. Who else can we call? Like, that must have been, what, 4 or 5 phone calls? And like maybe one phone call. Because everyone has that attitude about it. Whoever got that call was going to say yes no matter what. We may have been the first call.
But Kimmel was better than that.
Yes.
And obviously a business choice. And everybody wanted to go with the smart
American capitalistic Which I believe capitalism is slightly sociopathic, if not all the way sociopathic. And so it's like...
I seem to get a lot of you guys on my show.
No doubt. Yeah. Birds of a feather flock together.
Bunch of the rebels come on my head. I love it.
Yes. They got... You know what's crazy is that, like, I think, like, on the deeper universal layers of my dream, of what I was really trying to, like, go and have fulfilled... I think this is, like, scripted to my subconscious of needing a reason to protest. Of just, like, let me face this thing that I'm against, the thing that I protest against, the man. Let me meet the man. I met him. Oh, man. I met him. And I became him in some weird ways.
Well, I think we've kind of set the stage for the final act here in that, you know, here... Like, the dream is coming true, or at least the idea of the dream. You know, the big cake is in front of you. You're eating it, like this sweet cake with frosting and everything you always wanted, and somehow it's not tasting sweet. Somehow you can't enjoy it at all, but it's too much salt in it or something like that.
Yeah, like it's oversalted.
Yeah, it's like somehow this I thought this was what it was, and everybody is telling me so, but it's not.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the other side of the mountain now.
So from that point, I was unanimously outvoted, and from that point on, I was unanimously outvoted about like 99% of things. Anytime my mouth opened, because I am now the crazy person who has no logic, and I don't care about putting bread on our table. I'm a danger to the brand that is now our key to survival, because we have to throw everything into it to make it happen, and it's happening and it's going crazy. So it's like, why would anyone want to stop that gold rush? So now I'm like this dangerous loose cannon
and the front man.
Yes. And there were four fronts.
Oh
yes. So that was one of the brilliant things is you put, I put 19 lead singers in a band together,
and it was a collective.
It was a super band of our collective. It was the best representation that we could come up with at the time, I guess. And it was amazing. My friend used to call it the Rocktopus. I loved that. So from that point on, there was a huge struggle and a fight and a compromise. And I was going to quit. I was literally going to quit and go to San Francisco. And they were going to go on Kimmel. And I was just like, screw this. And they're like, you're not going to go on. And I, like, had this whole thing. I ended up sitting in, like, a men's circle and sought counsel with the elders. And we, like, debated it for, like, 8 hours through the night, like, the night before. It was crazy. It was amazing. And,
Wow.
Yeah. It was, there, like, happened to be a ceremony, and I got invited to it. And I was, it was
amazing. Huh?
Yeah, super gnarly.
You plumbed the depths of your soul.
And then from there, I got picked up from there and then taken to an intervention where my mentor and... my secret wife at the time, Liana Sananda, and Papa Bear, Aaron Glass, the gentleman who we were doing the show with, he was like on, I don't know if we had FaceTime, he was just on the phone at that point. Like the three of them sat me down, he's in San Francisco, and the two of them are with me, and like, so I have the phone and the two, and like my three most deep friend and love people are like, you're gonna go on the show, and it's okay. And you need to go do this.
You're going
to
go on Jimmy Kimmel.
You're going to go on it. And I'm like, Aaron, I can't bail on you. He's like, you have to. And I'm like, and he's like, I appreciate you wanting to be up here and like the spirit thing that you're doing. And it sucks. But like, I cannot let you walk away from this right now over this. Like, you have to go ride this ride. And I was obsessed with Hunter S. Thompson for most of my life leading up to that point. And my mentor, Christian, he knew that. And he's just like, buy the ticket, take the ride, bro. And I'm like, oh, damn it. All right, let's go.
So you do Kimmel.
So we do it. And I guilt the band and like find us flights to get us up there after Kimmel, because Kimmel tapes in the afternoon. So we have to get pulled from the bill officially for the Great American Music Hall. And but like I was like, well, we could get up there and make it for Aaron's set, and we could go get on stage with him at least we could, like, again, with the, you know, the super crazy upside down backwards thing, you get the thing that you were originally striving for, but it's like through this weird sacrifice thing, you know. And then I missed the flight. I took Fairfax. The band went in the Kimmel van from the taping, and I took Fairfax in my car, and it was like crazy construction, and I missed the flight, and the band gets on it and goes to San Francisco, and I'm stuck in the airport. I have no money in my pocket. I had to borrow money so that I could get the next flight, and I ended up arriving like 30 minutes after them, thank God. It was just insane. It was like the battle.
Crazy.
This endless battle. Yeah.
Chaos.
But so for me, like in this weird way, from that moment on, and a lot of this has to do with my own internal traumas and my own mental illness that I was like completely unaware of at this point, and the way that I filter things. You know, it's like I see the world through the eyes that I'm programmed with, in a sense. I haven't really begun to undo some of that programming that's operating on this autopilot. It's like, for me, everything is broken. So it makes the cake even less sweet. And like every time, and I'm constantly having to eat it, and it's now my only food source. And it gets like more bitter and more bitter. And I ride through the rest of the year. And that's when we go and do all these amazing festivals and this whole thing. And I'm just sitting there, and I like became this vision in my head of like, you know, I was the one who kind of had the seed of this band, and I like threw everything into it and got everybody together and like wrote this music and sang it every night with every fiber of my being, and like just tried to do the thing. And I equated myself to like them putting me in a cage on a pirate ship, and we're sailing, and it was this pirate ship that I had built. They built with me, but it was like, you know, this thing I had architected in my head. And now I'm a prisoner on it every night, and they take me and like wheel me out onto the stage, and I'm in the cage, and I perform, and they wheel me back and put me in the hole, and they're like, just keep him there. And I just tried to get through it with a smile on my face to try to fulfill what I felt my artistic mission was, which was to share this happy music and have a blast. And so it was this thing, this dual pole thing of like, yes, excuse me, of amazingness and detriment. And my goodness, yeah, it was crazy. And then at the end of 2013, it was like the night before New Year's, we're in Vegas opening for Imagine Dragons, and you know, like the relationships in the band are so bad, and I am like so contributing to it in this way that I was not aware of until more recently. Like I had such a wall of resent around me that they were looking at me like this crazy person, and I was doing the exact same thing to them. And we became so far apart because we just all of a sudden, something like a bridge was burned, and no one was trying to rebuild it. And it was just getting worse and worse. And it was like suddenly we're like on separate sides of this river, and it's like instead of building a bridge, we're like assembling armies at each other, like just in case who's going to fire first. And it's just like this tension. And man, it was like, it's been such a teacher going through that. But so it's like 2 years, it's like two nights before New Year's 2013. We are in Vegas with Imagine Dragons, who was like 20x blowing up that year of what we were. And we're opening for them in their hometown show night before New Year's. And that night something happened, and there was another vote, and the band was like just something I wanted to do. It was a song that I wanted to sing that night. It was just like another one of these things. Whenever I wanted to do something, they were like, all seven would be like, no. I'd be like, oh my God, everything. That's like, I should have said another thing and then tried to, you know, manipulate it politically so that by saying the thing they thought I wanted, they would go with the other thing. I was like, I should have done something like that, like some weird Jedi mind trick. So I wasn't like thinking about stuff like that.
Right. Like, you know, the kid or something.
Yeah.
Like,
and then
reverse psychology.
And that night, like something happened before we walked out on stage. And I was like, I think this, I'm committed to two shows. I'm committed to this show. And then New Year's Eve, we're like doing some huge show in Long Beach for the New Year's celebration. And we're not like doing anything, because it's like it's winter break. The industry kind of shuts down, and everyone's going to reset for the next year. And we're like kind of between all the bookings. I'm like, I've fulfilled my obligation. I think I'm going to leave my band. My friend Deepak, he always sings. He goes, I quit my band in San Francisco. instead of losing my head. But
right.
So at Imagine Dragons, I'm like, wow, I'm going up here. I'm opening for the biggest band, one of the biggest rock bands in the world at the time. And I'm like, I can't do this. This means nothing to me. And not only that, I'm starting to feel like I'm contributing to this monster that I've created. And like, I don't want any part of it anymore. And I'm feeling so unfulfilled and just lost. And I'm like, I'm out. And so, like, New Year's Day, I go to the managers, and I'm like, I finished the New Year's Eve show, and the next day, I'm like, I go, it's 2014 now, I'm like, I'm out of this band, we have a sit-down, it doesn't go well, and it's just like, my mind is made up. And then the label is like, well, let us give you a solo deal. I'm like, cool, awesome, we'll do a new thing, great. But this is the same label that betrayed our agreement day one. Day official Monday morning, day one after signing, and I'm like, and they're contributing. They're part of the unanimous no's and like all the stuff that I'm feeling toxic with, and so I get gassed by them. They give me this whole pitch. Now there's numbers and a new deal, and I don't have still very much money. Like we made all this money, but we didn't see any of it because there were eight people in the band and splits, and then
managers, agents.
Yeah, and they do, man, they do some weird stuff.
They're good with accounting.
Oh my gosh.
You get a nickel out of 100 folks.
Yeah, it's crazy. And it's been a battle. It's been an ongoing battle. Because every year, if I ever go look at numbers to this day, I'm short. And I have to call them and be like, hey. And they're like, oh, we're so sorry about that. And I'm like, what the heck is going on? And I'm like, how much am I really short?
And so when you left the band, was it pretty much the end of the band?
No, the band continued for years. They only just broke up, like, during the pandemic.
Oh, okay. The Mowglis had some game.
They went and did their thing.
I did not.
Yeah.
Okay.
I looked at them and I was like, go.
Okay.
Do your thing.
And you wished them well?
Yeah.
Okay.
Uh-huh. But we didn't speak, and then it got more and more tumultuous in the separation, and it went to legal battles and...
Yeah.
And one of my, it's so funny. This one email like makes the entire thing worth it. Like one of the record label lawyers, somebody wrote me because I was trying to maintain my ownership of the brand that I created, and it's like 11%. Everyone has an even cut. I made sure everybody had an even cut, and I'm like, I'm just gonna maintain my ownership, and they're like, we're not gonna be out there making you money. I'm like, but you're like sailing in this ship that I created. Like, you know, those are my riffs. Like, why not? And they're looking at me like I'm crazy. And no, you're not. You're going to get your cuts from the songs because that's undoable once it's published.
Publishing.
So like, that's what you get. And I'm like, no. So we get into this battle. And
you're talking about artist share as opposed to publishing
and
share.
And I'm talking about like merch from stuff like... Whatever the brand was bringing in, I wanted my percentage of it.
And there's plenty of bands that artists get nothing.
Were all getting the same cut that I was.
But some bands, like some rich guy on a yacht, gets every dollar of the artist's take, and that, you know, the artists on stage just get like a nightly. So
yeah.
This is not uncommon.
No.
That somebody who's not actually performing gets a piece of the artist's share.
True.
Yeah. True. Yeah. Obviously.
But
people who put together bands, mm-hmm. Nobody even knows each other. Suddenly they're on stage performing because they're cute and they can sing. But there's some other guy back there, you know, Simon Cowell or somebody who's collecting all that cash.
Right. But in this case, it's like the founder of the company that's going to continue to make money. It's like, cut me a royalty.
You actually are the source of the whole thing.
Uh-huh.
So I'm not even complaining about that. Alleged guy. I'm
right.
You know, that's
normal.
Fine. You put it together. Why shouldn't you? But you actually have even more skin in the game.
Sure.
Because it wouldn't have happened without you.
Yeah.
It's really, you're a part of that.
And their argument is it wouldn't have happened without us either. And I'm like, yes, but it's us. So we all maintain that.
Right.
And we go into this battle, and I get an email this one day, and their lawyer said, if you do not comply with this agreement of me getting written out right off the bat, then we will never let you release your music again. And I'm like, holy what? This is like from Island or something. And I'm like, what is going on?
Wow.
And so my mom, one of her friends is an entertainment attorney, and she... My mom does estate planning, and she just, like, has all these friends. And so I had, thankfully, I had support. I had, like, a team easily So when we went to battle with them, it wasn't like the label was going to bleed me dry.
You're so broke.
Because I have homie lawyer situations, and we have like legal stuff in our family. So we were able to go toe-to-toe with them a little bit, which was still insane and too expensive. And they're like, they wouldn't let me out of the contract. We end up getting in some bad deal, like where it's like they're going to give me a piece for 5 years and I'm sunsetting out. And it's just like, at one point I was just like, I can't do this anymore and I have to accept it. And even then, they still weren't letting me out of the contract. And this is also one of my favorite parts of the story that makes the entire experience completely worth it, which is that when we started the collective, me and Christian, my mentor, and he produced the Mowglis, he produced San Francisco, Christian Hand, he and I were sitting down at Swing House Studios, where he actually had a radio show on Sirius. They had like a little Sirius studio in Swing House in Hollywood, and all the bands would rehearse at that same building. So we were there a lot, rehearsing for years. It was like our favorite spot. We were sitting out at that table one night when we were first starting the collective, and we're like, and he's the one who said, you know, let's do collective instead of record label. He's like, we need to come up with a business plan. And I'm like, you're the one that was like, we're just going to do this together. He's like, I know, but we need to figure this out. Let's sit down and do it. And he starts writing down numbers, and it starts to look just like, I don't know how to pitch this to my friends and get everyone to agree to it, and like how this is going to make money. And I just was like annoying him and everything he would put down. And he was starting to agree too. And he just wrote these words on this piece of paper with his Sharpie. And he was at NYU as an English major, and one of the classes there, everybody had to create their own font with handwriting, so like an alphabet, and copy it every time, and you would write in your font. So he has his signature font, and in his badass signature font, he wrote the words contract, underlined it, and then it just said, we love each other. And that was it. And I was like, dude, that's it. And he's like, you're such a friggin' hippie. And I'm like, this is it. You wrote it. You've done it. It can't be undone now. So when we bonded the collective, we bonded the Mowglis, and we bonded all the people that we worked with, everyone would sign this contract that said, we love each other. And when I signed with the label, best believe that was the last page of the contract. I made them sign that because I was so scared of these people, especially. I was like, well, you know what? I don't know what all this stuff is, and I know that things are going to get weird. At least sign this for me. This is my one. This is a deal breaker if you don't sign this. And I had the publisher sign it. I had the manager sign it. Everyone in the band, like everybody signed this thing. I still have people sign it that I work with to this day, because it's like at any point I can look at it and be like, hey, remember? And with the band, I would do that. It didn't work at the time, but with Island, towards the end of this legal battle, and my lawyer, like, giving up, she's like, dude, I don't know what to do. We're standstill, and we were still compensating her with something. It was like, I was starting to get, you know, they were starting to win, because it was like, we can't fight with them. I sent one of them in their legal team, maybe I CC'd a whole bunch of people. I sent them a screenshot of the contract that they signed. I was like, Island signed this or whatever. The label signed this. They let me go like the next day. And like after like 6 months of battling with them, I sent them a screenshot of the We Love Each Other contract, and boom, I'm free. I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. Like how, like a more perfect thing could not have had, like it's just so magic and like beautiful and blessed. And I was like, my goodness, wow.
The end.
That was awesome. Yeah, so then that's how that ended.
Well, a beautiful telling, Michael Mowgli.
Mm.
And just in closing, in summary, let me take the role of somebody 50 years from now who's looking back at this little scene and just giving a little analysis of what happened. Okay?
Yes.
So this is, we're actually just identifying this symbolic nature, the archetypes of what was happening. Because this whole story is about archetypes. Because these are deep flows in society that somehow you were playing out as a key player for a while.
Sure.
Okay? So I'm Mystic P there, 50 years, whatever, right in the biography of this. So there's three central themes.
Mm-hmm.
And one is the young, idealistic artist, perhaps a genius, full of dreams, passionate, maybe a little off, maybe some mental illness in there, but just this wild creative force that's rare, that we love, that we're attracted to, charismatic. Everybody loves this force, this man, this beautiful man with the beautiful golden hair. So there's that one character. And then we have the villain. So it's reality. It's the record company. You know, you could have been selling Tupperware. You could have been selling toothpaste. They don't care. Whatever it is, the object that you presented to them, this magical object, they don't care what it is. They just want to make money. They have no eyes for this enchanted creation you have. And look, that's most of the world. And if I don't play that game myself and I don't pay my rent on time, I'm going to be sleeping in my car or under a bridge. So that reality is a real reality and something that just like most of the people on the planet are playing. It's money. It doesn't care how you feel. It doesn't care how magical, enchanted, or wondrous, or dreamlike it is. It's just like, can I pay the rent? Can I pay my stockholders? Toothpaste, Tupperware, brilliant music. And there's actually a third player too. But so is that evil? Is that the villain? Or is that just like, you know, basic foundational reality? But that's the good question here. Are they really as evil as they seem? Or, nah, that's just the world. And then there's this third force, this ancillary force, which is the band. It's just like the bystanders, the people trying to make sense of it all, trying to hang on, good-hearted people, a brotherhood, sisterhood, family, but now faced with all this trauma and crazy decisions and nobody knows what's going on. Everybody's hanging on for their dear life, trying to make sense of it, making good decisions, making bad decisions, bad blood, good. You know, like, there's that force of just utter chaos. And there's actually one or more force, and that's me, Mystic Pete, watching on his TV, the musician who's been trying and begging and kissing butt and doing everything he can to get ahead, and he's watching his buddy there making it big, and he ain't. He's just at home with nothing. You know what I mean? So, yeah, that's my little coda part of the story. Not trying to steal any of it from you, but, you know, that's a part of it. You know, and maybe my envy, maybe that's all of it. Like, we're all, like, scrambling, and we're all trying to get our own piece, and, you know, and we have to cut corners here and there and sell out, and nobody knows what they're doing. And the guys at the record label sometime down the road, they may go like, God, why were we such jerks? Why couldn't we have just been a little more gracious? Just a little more gracious. Let him have his week with Bandcamp. Just keep the vibe nice. How did anybody benefit from that one week at Bandcamp? And that might have just changed the whole trajectory. Then Michael Mobley might have gone like, oh, okay. They showed up a little. I can make some sacrifice. That one decision, maybe, would have changed everything. But everybody had to, like, scramble for, like, the last nickel. Everybody, like, went down to the most selfish possible decision they could. Anyway, these are the archetypes that you played out, you wrestled with. And I'm sure many people would be envious to have that moment. Even the light of it, the top of the mountain, even the crash and burn and the destruction, the annihilation of it all. I don't know. It's kind of exciting. Anyway, thank you, Michael Mowgli.
Oh, you're so welcome.
For my recounting of...
I'm so honored by that. Thank you. It's so weird and ironic, too, because in some ways, if I could be looking through the TV back at you, I'd be like, if I could... I'd give anything to be that guy right now. I'd trade places with me. Come stand here and
let's
see
do it. Let's go. I'll work on my time machine. When all is said and done, there's the battle. You pick up your spear and you go, your spear, and you charge into it, and you're wounded and almost die, and that's life.
Yeah.
That's living.
As we wrap this up, if there are any Mowglis listening or any friends of Mowglis listening, I just want to say I love you and I'm sorry and thank you. And wow. I hope we can reunite one day in an epic, amazing Aroctopus.
We love each other.
We love each other. Boom. Yes.
Ah, that's good. Coming to the end of the Mystic Pete Chronicles, you can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. In today's show, I interviewed the magnificent Michael Mowgli and then played the song that he was so much a part of, San Francisco. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next week with the best of talk radio. Mystic Pete out!